I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
First item on our agenda is to approve the minutes from our previous meeting. If I can have a motion for that, so moved. Moved by Commissioner Vickery.
Second.
Second by Commissioner Rahauser. Any questions? If not, I'll signify by saying aye.
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 The next item is to approve our agenda, and I have two additions to the agenda I would like to add. The first one is we have Nancy Weir here from the state DEQ department to talk to us briefly this morning, and I'd like to put her on after Mark Pape, just before Shad Cooper. And then the other thing is we have three surety bonds that we need to approve, and I'll put that after Todd Forsman before we get to monthly reports. So if I could have a motion to accept the agenda as amended, please.
So moved. Second.
Moved by Commissioner Noble, seconded by Commissioner Rahauser. Any other additions, comments? If not, I'll signify by saying aye.
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 Motion carries. We're now ready for Mark Pape with Tegelman Insurance. Okay. Preach to us.
That's nice. I don't have to just walk around. Morning, gentlemen. We're talking about our property and casualty insurance that comes effective 4/1. You should have a spreadsheet in there that kind of shows you all the different, basically the coverages, the lines of business that we're talking about. But I've also put our last 5 years worth of history on there, so we can kind of, because that's important to kind of track through where we've been, the carriers we've been with, and really what our proposals for this year are. If you kind of go back to 2014, that was the last year we had with Travelers. We've been with them since 2010. And we moved to One Beacon in 2015, primarily due to some service issues and especially premium issues that we were having with Travelers. I know Joel can remember going back to 2012, 2013, they were taking some double-digit rate increases, and we just needed to find another market that we went to. We found One Beacon. They were basically new to the state at that point. They'd only been writing one other entity in Wyoming when we started working with them in 2015. You can kind of see that number of 408,992 is where they came in with, and that beat Travelers renewal at that time by about $35,000. And so we kind of started off then to see what we were going to be able to do. And if you kind of follow that bottom line number across, you can kind of see what they did for us in the last 4 years. They kept working with us on premium and working with us on loss control, knowing that we were improving, we were getting better, and they were rewarding us for that. So when we got to this year, 2019, we brought One Beacon out last week of February, and they did some loss control. They did loss control. They came out and they looked at the landfills and the transfer stations. Our loss control person went out with Billy, and they took a look at that. They also put on two employment practice workshops for us. They coordinated that with Carrie, and she got two of these workshops scheduled for us. They came out and they provided those with our department heads. We had some new department heads come in. I think it was very good training for them. They were very well attended. I basically gave all the carriers, gave me their quotes by 3/1. We'd have them in time. When Beacon, while they were here, gave me their initial quote. It was initially about 2% more than last year. Pretty flat, a little bit exposure rating, a little bit of rate increase. But after the meetings, after they worked with Carrie, after they worked with your group and they did the workshops, they really appreciate the fact that we're looking at potentially going with a human resource manager type to carve that piece out and be better on our employment practice side, with the landfills, with all the loss control that we're currently doing. So they came back to us with a new number. That's the box number right there at 364. That's about $15,000 less, 4% less than we paid last year. So again, all those meetings that they had coming out here, I took their business development, underwriting, and loss control people. We went around, we looked at buildings. And again, they've been with us since the same underwriter I've had since 2015. And they're very, they can't emphasize the partnership that they have with Sullivan County in terms of how we continually are being proactive to get better. So they brought us back a number of 364, which I think was just indicative of the partnership that we have. However, we did put this out to other carriers. I got a quote from Travelers, but they didn't give me their quote until 311. But if you go to that far right box, you can see they came up with a number of 312, which is a pretty crazy number. they're not going to be able to maintain that number, and it has some different coverages. There's some different deductible issues. There's some different things with it. And they even admit that that's not going to be a number they're going to stay at. But they're basically trying to buy your business back. They realize now that our claims are getting better, that we're not pretty much where we used to be. And back in 2012, 2013, 2014, we were, you know, if you go back in time and look kind of way back here to the left, we had some pretty significant claim issues. 2007 to 2010, the insurance companies that four-year period paid out $1.8 million in claims. That doesn't count what we paid out in terms of deductibles and other things. It came down the next 4 years to about $550,000, and the last 4 years were down to a couple hundred thousand, and $164,000 of it this year, $142,000 of that was just the fire claim at Kismet Field. So our claim scenarios are getting much better. They want back in, but you're not going to stay at that same number. So if it's a matter of we wanted to save a lot of money, you can go with that. Understand there's going to be some processes you're going to have to take with that. But that's up to the commission in terms of where you guys want to go. With that, I went back to One Beacon and said, okay, guys, Traveler came in with a crazy number. If you guys want to take a last look, you can. That's the next, that middle shaded box. They said, well, about the only thing we can do is try to match some of their coverages, match some of their deductibles, take a few things away. The lowest number we can get to is the 342 number. So when I look at this, my recommendation obviously is the squared box. To try to keep the coverage that we currently have, the relationship we currently have, everything as we currently have today, and continue to move it forward, save a lot of money, and because we can save a dollar today and pay $5 tomorrow, and that's pretty much what we're going to be looking at as we move further to the right. But again, it's a lot of money to save, and I know you look at this and you're probably thinking, well, gee, Mark, you're an insurance agent, you guys be paid on commission, and the middle box is the highest premium, that's what you're asking me to do. I can tell you that we would make more money as an agency based off commission rates and contracts with the Traveler's number than we would the One Beacon number. But I'm also a stakeholder, I'm a taxpayer, and I've got to see behind the curtain for the last basic 10 years in terms of where we've been, what we've had to do, how we've got to where we are today. And my recommendation is to take the middle one right there. It keeps you where you are, it keeps the same partnership, and One Beacon's been very good to work with. From a claim standpoint, they've been very good. They're partnered with us, and they're coming back with lower numbers even before they knew what the competitors were looking at, saying, we think we're doing the right things. So we can get into any of the specific coverages. I just kind of wanted to take you through that spreadsheet, kind of show you what the proposals were, kind of how we got there, and then anything that we need to talk about from there.
Mark, could you maybe explain a little bit, you made a comment that when the, I don't know how you referred it to, the training staff, the folks that came by to talk to the department heads and do the review, that one thing that was, I guess brought up, one thing that was mentioned, and you also mentioned it into the formula for reducing these costs, and that is some sort of program for human resources. Can you tell us what their thinking was on that, or what your anticipation on that is?
Yeah, kind of what they look at, and that really factors into our employment practices. The employment practice liability is all your liability that you assume from any type of in your human resources, from hiring, firing, employee relations. So those are some pretty large claims, and we've had a couple of pretty big hits over the years where we've had those issues, and when we have them, they're usually in the hundreds of thousands of dollars of payouts. So the insurance company looks at that and they say, okay, how can we reduce our chance of loss in that department? And as especially public entities, you know, most public entities, especially ones of our size, they don't have separate human resource departments. Those responsibilities are kind of tasked on a number of individuals, whether it be the county attorney's office or the county clerk, and it's whether it's towns or counties, that's kind of where it ends up. One of the questions I asked our loss control person who had talked to Carrie about this was, from all the public entities you guys write, and they write all over the country, what's the threshold that you see from the standpoint of when entities go from just, hey, we're all just going to like band together and try to tackle this, to we're going to carve out a department that's going to specifically focus on that? And he said, we normally see when you get to that 150 to 175 employee count range, entities are moving toward that because it's too much. There's too much to handle. There's too many people to try to manage by committee, by group, because there's too many holes that don't get filled. and we're about 160, 170. So we're right there at the top end of that threshold. They see when they see these go, and when they see that, when they see entities that have human resource departments that specialize and focus just on that exposures, claims are lower because you've got somebody that's got their eye just on that. They're dealing with policies and procedures. They're dealing with making sure everybody's got handbooks. When there's a new change to your policy or a handbook or any type of procedure, they're making sure that information gets pushed out to everybody. It's not like, well, I think we got everybody. Did everybody get a copy of that? Whose job is it to look at that? That's where your holes come into play. And that's where, when you have these claims and these things go to lawsuits, that's how we lose those things. So they looked at that and said, the fact that you're looking at that and the fact that you're looking at potentially moving to that and developing that, we're gonna reward you for that, because we look at that as there's future claims that we probably won't have. And we haven't really had any lately. We've been pretty good. But as Matt said during the meeting, we've also been pretty lucky because those things happened. We just, you know, we probably dodged a bullet here or there. But this is a process that will help us dot more I's, cross more T's.
So the recommendation, the expectation, and a consideration of One Beacon is that we are going to, or we will be moving towards carving out that position.
Yeah, they, based off those conversations and you talk about this is something that we're looking at doing, Carrie asked some questions. She talked to the loss control person at One Beacon and asked for some additional information of how, you know, other resources we could look at to help develop this and define what that would look like. And they were like, that's just, even the conversations that you're having moving toward that means that you're being proactive and looking to get better. And that's, from their standpoint, that's what they're looking for. Are we being proactive and trying to move down the road and be better from loss control and improve ourselves, or are we just saying, hey, we're good, we don't need to do anything? And that's, and they're rewarding you from that standpoint. Whether you do or you don't, they're not going to come back and add money back to you if you don't develop that, but they're looking at that as at least you're identifying, hey, we have things we can do to get better. We all can get better at everything. So this is one of those steps we're taking. And the fact that you're addressing it from their standpoint was huge.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Davis.
Mark, you said that Travis' number at 312 was a crazy number.
Yes, it's
a crazy number. Expand up just a tiny bit on that.
Well, when we look at what we're paying in terms of premiums, if you go back to 2010 with Travelers, when they first wrote with them, and that, I don't have this on the page, their total premium is $334. We've got $25 million worth more property on the books today than we had then. Rates haven't gone down. So what they're trying to do, they're trying to give you a number. It's like I'm making you an offer you can't refuse. Basically, that's what they're saying. We want your business back. We lost it because of our service and our premiums and what we did to you before. We know that. But we're just going to try to buy that number back. They're not going to stay at this number. They've already given me, because the first thing I did was call the underwriter and said, man, what are you doing? Give me a number that I can take in that, I mean, how am I supposed to take in a 312 number when, you know, 4 years ago you were 445, because that's what their renewal premium would have been in 2015. He goes, well, we don't want to look at the past. I said, well, these gentlemen are going to look at the past. They're going to ask me about the past, so we got to look at that. And he said, well, we'll try to cap our rate increase, not exposure, not claims, not anything else, just rate. We'll try to cap that at 5% next year. So they're already admitting that there's going to be rate changes next year. They also do some things that they'll charge you back. They have more deductibles. They audit for your autos. There's a lot of things that you're going to pay more money during the course of the year that puts it back in, the things that One Beacon doesn't do. So, I mean, if you just want to say, hey, we want to go with the lowest price bid initially, if you want to look at it that way, then you have Travelers. Understand that journey is going to be a little more difficult. There's going to be more work. They're going to come out and they're going to loss control a lot, which means they'll come out, and in essence, what Dr. Burnett said is, hey, we want to see your resource, and this is something that we're the expectation. They'll give you a loss control with. It's not a recommendation. It's an implementation. And that's where we get into issues with some of the carriers when they do loss control. When they came out, they worked with Billy out there. They came back with two things that they said, here's some recommendations that we would like to see. I think it would help you. One is signing, so just some, I don't know if you've seen that before, yet, Bill. Okay, it's just one was signing. We'd like to see, you know, things like, you know, keep your kids and dogs and pets in the cars, and just some generic type of signing that's consistent at both transfer stations that helps identify, you know, potential losses. And the other is the one dumpster that people could literally back off into if they really weren't paying attention to some type of barrier. But those are recommendations. They're not saying we're giving you 45 days to implement this. If you don't, they were either going to rate you or we're going to not, you know, carry your policy. There's a difference in terms of how insurance companies work on loss control. Some are much more like, here's what we need to see from you, and others are like, we want to partner with you to help you get better. So the traveler's number, it's not a realistic number. You're not going to pay anywhere near that next year. You're going to pay a lot more, and you're going to pay more throughout the course of the year. Example, audits on autos. One Beacon doesn't audit on your composite auto rating. Travelers does. Right now we have 145 vehicles on the schedule. That's pretty much the lowest we've been in a while. 2 years ago we were 171. So if you plan on buying any autos this year, what how your rate works on the autos is it's composite rated. They charge a rate per unit on the vehicles for the liability and a rate for the total cost or valuation of the vehicles. So they charge a rate for that. So if you add autos during the course of the year, we don't endorse an ad throughout the course of the year. At the end of the year, we look at that schedule, and One Beacon says, okay, you went from 145, next year you have 155, we rate on 155 moving forward. Travelers would say next year, we'd sit there looking at 155, and they're like, okay, you got 10 more vehicles, we're gonna charge you back. If you've ever been through a commercial general liability audit, you know what I'm talking about from that. So they audit back on that. So you can save a few bucks today, like I said, save a dollar today, pay five tomorrow in your relationship. It's going to be a little bit different. Travelers is a good company. I'm not. I just know what we went through back here to get to here, and I know the conversations I had with. I mean, Joel was in on these meetings, and I know some of them weren't very pleasant. And I don't like not pleasant. So, again, the box is the one that I would recommend. That obviously, Joel, can go the direction you want to go.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
One Beacon has the obviously the boxed one and the shaded one for two different prices. What is the, is it significantly different policies or is it just?
Well, there's some things in the policy language they can't change, but what they did is they tried to say, okay, well, what was Travelers offering to get such a low number? Things like, okay, they'll audit back on autos. They'll change some of their deductibles because they can't just say, you know, they were like, they came up with a number, and I gave them, said, here's your target. I mean, here's the lowest guy on the total pole here. So this, if you want to look at this and have a last look, you can. And they were like, man, we came back and we gave you a number. And I said, well, but if I go in with 360 and another with 312, I mean, you're off far enough. If you want to have another chance to look at it, the only way they can do that is to try to match some of Travelers' covers and do some of the things that Travelers doing. It takes some things away to get to the number, then there's some things they can't change. Some things are just policy level that are built in that they can't reduce back that are in some cases significantly different. But it's a little bit more money you're saving, but you're also giving a little bit back. You're kind of moving from here down to here to here. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner.
Are we obligated to take the lowest bid?
Not in this case, no.
Okay.
And the recommendation, I think what Mark is saying is his recommendation based on not only his years of experience in terms of working with this policy, but based on the specific policy programs of what he's been given, his recommendation to us today is that we renew the policy with One Beacon. Is that correct?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So I guess my next question is do we need a motion?
Yes, but Commissioner Bell.
Before we do, Mr. Chairman, I think in looking back on this and some of the problems we had before, I think to me, one of the big advantages we've derived from One Beacon is their willingness to work with us, work with our department heads, and avoid liability. And I think if you look back even prior to 2014, if you look at what we've saved in claims, I think is pretty darn significant. And that it does reinforce the concept that we need to put some more emphasis on some coordinated human resource management. Now, how we do that, I don't know. I think we're going to have to involve specifically one of our biggest sources of liability is law enforcement, and we're going to have to pull all our departments together and sit down with Mark and One Beacon and figure out how do we write a job description that and our county attorney's office can help us in that too. But how can we write a job description where now everybody's law enforcement kind of doing their thing, road and bridge is kind of doing their thing. How do we coordinate that to where we get to the point that we're think we need to go? And I guess that's kind of a question.
Yeah.
I value your input too, Mark.
Yeah, and I know Carrie, she was talking to Kenny about the loss control person. He's in Denver, and they've come out before and done workshops, and they were having some conversations about, okay, human resources, how do we build that? How do we build? There's some different companies you can use that can give you sample job descriptions, sample forms and things that you can template off of and work from that, because you're not going to look like anybody else. So it's kind of like, how do we kind of want to see what visions are out there and then mold our own that fits what we do. But they're willing to continue to do whatever they can, and those services they provide for free. I mean, they come out and do this stuff. It doesn't cost us, these workshops and stuff doesn't cost us anything. So they're willing to continue to work whatever they can offer to us.
I think Commissioner Bousman is correct in terms of involving the various entities. And I think that moving forward, this process is more likely going to be in a stepwise approach. Mm-hmm. And I think, Carrie, you probably can take the lead on that with the county attorney's office, get the appropriate people together so we can gather their input and develop that stepped approach that we need to do.
It'll pay dividends down the road. I mean, the work you have to do today to develop that and have that, but when down the road, you're going to continue to see, just not only from loss control, but just human resources, just your people working on their jobs. It's just going to help tie a lot of that together for you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
One small question, Mark. The original and the revised, what was the differential? What created the differential in those?
Well, their original, when they came back, that was a number based off the meetings, and but then when I got the traveler's quote, and again they couldn't get it to me on the right date, but I went back to One Beacon and said, okay, we've got a competing quote out here that's this number. So if you guys want to have a last look at it, if you want to look at your premium, say, is there something you can do to become more competitive? Can you take some, but do whatever you have to do, but this is the number that these guys are sitting out here. These are the kind of deductibles they're looking at. Here's some of their policy forms. This is what they look at. You're here now, they're here. So do you want to try to get closer? So they said, we can move, from the 360 to the 340, but we're going to have to take some things away. We're going to have to try to start matching what the other guy's doing. We're going to have to start adding some deductibles back in. We're going to have to start auditing for autos. We're going to have to take some of the easy things that we can do. We can't change our policy forms, and we can't change all the language in the policy, but we can do some of the other things to get us to that point. And that's really where that shift comes to play. The thing I like about One Beacon's forms, that they're very broad, which means we have special causal laws forms. It means our everything's covered unless it's excluded. So unless it's excluded in there, it's a covered exposure. An example, how that works for us, when we added in the acupuncturist at the public health, it was very simple. I called the underwriter and I called loss control. I said, here's what we want to do. We want to take this acupuncturist, put him in the public health for this detox. How do you guys feel about that? They talked, we had a number of questions. We had to go back and forth with Matt and county attorney's office in terms of getting some of that. We talked to public health, got all the information, went back to them. They said, okay, from what you're doing, loss control signed off on it, underwriting signed off on it. We just added it in. There was no additional premium. There was no real problem. It was a nice, easy way to fix it right up to the policy. That's not what you get all the time. So that's the relationship that they have with us. But to answer your question, if you move to the right, you're just giving away some coverage. And you're assuming you're retaining more of that yourself with higher deductibles.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Comments? Let's consider a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept One Beacon's 2019 revised quote for $342,962. Sorry. Doing some crap.
Is there a second? What do you point at?
So impact revised, One Beacon's revised,
right.
Mark's recommendation and the original proposal.
Yeah, the one, the square box, the original square one box is mine.
That's you're not, I'm sorry, I misunderstood then. You were asking for the original.
Yeah, the one in the share. The reason is, as you move to that right, to that, I put that one on there just so you guys would know that they were willing to do some, they were dropping the price a little bit more, but you're going to retain, you're going to pick some of the coverages back up. You're going to pick up some more deductibles and some of those other things. That's closer to matching the traveler's number. The original one, the 364, that was their initial revise. That's the original quote that they're now coming in with. So, I mean, if you want to go to that other number, you can. They're still with One Beacon. You're just going to pick up some additional coverages.
More mistake.
You're just going to retain a little bit more. You're going to get things like the auto, you know, you're going to get audited back on your autos. You're going to have some deductibles. There's going to be some things that are going to come back into play.
Okay.
So we didn't have a second. If you want to make a revised motion.
Mr. Chairman, I will revise my motion to accept One Beacon's 2019 original bid for $364,406.
Second. Okay. And moved and seconded by Commissioner Noble. Any further discussion? If not, I'll signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Thanks for your hard work.
No problem.
Yep, thanks, Mark.
Good thing is we still save money.
Yes.
I understand we get what we currently have, the relationship, but we still come away with money in our pocket, which doesn't happen much.
No, 4% is 4%.
Yeah, that's it.
Thanks, Mark. All right. The next item would be our added agenda item with Nancy Veer from DEQ. Welcome, Nancy. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you all for having me. I know some of you from various air quality DEQ items, so for those of you that don't know me, I'm Nancy Veer from the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, Air Quality Division, and I'm here for two reasons. One is Jeff Wendt. The Air Quality Division, we're based in Cheyenne, but we also have district Air Quality District engineers. And Jeff Wendt, who's our district engineer for District 5 out of Lander, he'd been talking to Shad Cooper on some slash pile burning. And Shad had asked him to come down and talk to y'all. And then when I was talking to Jeff, part of the reason we want to talk about the slash pile burning is its relation to pollutants that get emitted in the air, and right now we're having an ozone season. I said, hey, Jeff, maybe I could come and then also give you guys an update on the ozone season so far. So appreciate that opportunity. So I'll first start off talking about the slash pile burning. A number of years ago, the Air Quality Division developed some rules and regulations related to smoke management. So when things burn, there's different pollutants that get released in the air. And some of those pollutants are things like particulate matter, carbon monoxide, volatile organic compounds, nitrogen oxides. And those two, nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds, I'm going to get to in a minute in terms of the ozone discussion. But when things burn and get emitted to the air, that's when it comes into the Air Quality Division's regulations. We want to minimize pollutants out there to protect public health. And so we had burning regulations, and these burning regulations are based on the size of what and the amount of what's being burned, the material that's being burned. If it's stuff like tires, those are things called prohibited materials because they can release things called hazardous air pollutants that get in the air. If it's things more like woody biomass and you have smoke with has a combination of different pollutants, we want to make sure that when it gets burned, the conditions are right for dispersion or kind of getting the pollutants in the air and out and not kind of setting down and coming over somebody's house or people nearby. And so we have regulations. One's geared toward what we call open burning, those smaller kind of burns, and then a smoke management program that's geared towards more your bigger burns, like when BLM goes out and does a very large burn. So when we have ozone action days, those where we look at the conditions, the meteorological conditions that are conducive to formation of ozone here in the basin, we look at those and we see what the conditions are. If we call an ozone action day, we actually have two inspectors here based out of Pinedale for the Jonah and the Anticline. And those inspectors go around and take a look and see if we can see if there's any issues going on related to air pollution. They're primarily focused on oil and gas operations. That's a primary source of pollutants. But there's other things that release those volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxides into the air. Every time we turn on a car, that tailpipe exhaust includes some of those. And one of the things they noticed was some burning going on, and I think that's where the discussions came with Shad when they were kind of chasing those down to talking to people, introducing themselves and saying, hey, they're from Air Quality Division. And so our message is, when it's this winter ozone season, our recommendation is just to try to avoid those kind of burning situations, those smaller burns, even though the load that they add into the airshed is pretty small. We'd still advise against doing those kind of burns during this January 1st to March 31st time frame. I have a whole bunch of rules and regs, not going to bore you with that. This is just one of those kind of what I call good neighbor, kind of good practices, if at all. There's times when you have to burn. We understand that. We recommend people, if they can hold off until it's a non-ozone action day, do that. If they can't hold off and wait till that January 1st to March 31st time frame. We do have a permit program that a lot of the cities and counties, when they have, they do like a community event for burning, and that's when Jeff and those get involved in terms of burn permits. Other requirements are in our rules and regs, and we're happy to answer any questions. We have people that specialize in that. So that's kind of on the slash pile. Burning message. Just try to avoid that January 1st to March 31st. If it's an emergency, if you need to burn, just give us a heads up. And if it's a situation where you do need to burn during those days, avoid burning on those ozone action days.
Nancy, do you have any requests or specific recommendations that we as the county ought to apply or action that we might need to take?
Recommendations are just what I would call those things that we as the division try to do as well. We're not always the best at that good communication back and forth. I think Jeff and Shad now have a communication link to communicate out there. Hey, when people call up, it seems like they're really good about calling the fire authority to say, hey, we're going to burn. So if you can pass that message on, hey, between that January 1st and March 31st, try to avoid burning. If you have to burn during that time frame, have it be on a non-ozone action day. That kind of message, pretty low-level stuff would be very useful, because that reduces what goes into the air, and then when we have those action days, that's less that we have to worry about.
Okay. While you were talking, our fire chief came in, and I'm not sure our fire chief knew you were going to be here, since we didn't converse till Friday afternoon.
I'm just standing.
Chad, if you would, we're talking about the air quality division regulations and avoiding slash burns. If you have anything you'd like to participate, join in, please do.
Yeah. Stand by just a quick second. Let me grab my notes. So let me introduce myself real quick. I'm Chad Cooper. I'm the fire chief. Very nice to meet you. So I received a phone call from Jeff. I'm not sure how much they caught you up, but I'll assume that you're completely briefed in. My perspective as a fire chief is that it makes sense. I think that if industry is taking steps to minimize the ozone impact, that maybe we can provide some recommendations to the public, and I'm willing to support that. But I think that it's a discussion that needs to be held at your level, at the county commissioner's level. I'm willing to follow whatever guidance you recommend, but I do think it makes sense, and I'm willing to support it. I think that if it's If it's something that we receive information from DEQ from, that we can provide that on our website, provide public education, and make recommendations to the public to minimize burning on those days that would have negative impact to the ozone action days. And I'd be willing to support that.
So I guess what I'm asking is, with both of you here, and that's a good thing, we depend on you and your expertise. What specifically can we do to help support recommendations? In other words, do we give you a direction? Is there something that we need to have an action item on, directing that we have, for instance, no slash pile burnings on ozone action days? That's what I'm asking. What do we need to do?
So my thought on that would be that our public is very good about calling our dispatch center and providing notification to our dispatchers that they're preparing to burn and that they want to minimize those false alarms, false calls to 911 when somebody drives by and sees smoke and calls 911. We want to try to minimize that. I think that'd be a good opportunity is if we have an ozone action day that our dispatchers could provide public education and say, hey, today's not a good day for burning. Can you hold off? And avoid the ozone action day timeframes. And then in general terms, I think that if I had the authority to publish on our websites and maybe even on the county's websites, general guidelines from the DEQ about timeframes when to avoid burning between January and March, basically, I think that would be a good effort on our part to provide the solution that they're looking for. And so that'd be something I'd be willing to support. The thing that I'm missing, though, is I don't have support from dispatch, and I don't want to speak for them saying that they'd be willing to be an intermediary or that interface with the public. And so before we took any action, I think that'd be the first step is have a conversation with the sheriff's office and have a conversation with the lead dispatch and say, here's what we're contemplating. How would that affect you, and is that a position you're willing to or a function you're willing to perform for us?
Mr. Chairman, my question is more to Billy because we have the transfer station where you burn on a frequent basis. I'm sure you're aware of all this.
Oh, yeah.
What are your action plans?
I've been dealing with Jeff and everybody. They, on ozone days and everything, they have a really good website. They send me alerts, and then I just make sure. And we try. We've been trying not to burn just when we desperately have to. I worked with Ms. Echeverry all the time, and she, we coordinate, but I know the ozone, and that webpage, if they send me alerts, tell me, is there bad days and all that. We've been doing it, for 2 years.
No, I'm just wondering if you could engage in this action plan and have it in written form also with Chad or something. Is that...
industry, they
have no unnecessary traffic in their area, so that you might be able to pull some of your guys out if there's no snow on the road that day.
We met with them a couple of years ago, and we try, mm-hmm. to do that, and we've been actually doing that stuff for the last couple of years. If it's bad ozone days, I don't have guys out just doing, we ain't out there.
No,
doing stuff that we can wait and stuff like that. We have it.
I'm sure you're conscious of it. I'm just wondering if that road and bridge department could be part of this conversation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering what the definition of slash burning really is, because I think slash burning to me is an accumulation of stuff after a logging company's been in there. So I think that's where we need to determine what slash burning really is.
What are you talking about, slash burning or just open burning on these days? Maybe you can
answer that.
Yeah, the reports that Jeff and Cindy had provided was that it was, I'll call it slash burning, pile burning. So I'll call it Russian trees, shrubs, kind of piles. We have in our regulations about a 1,250 cubic, feet of that material, and that falls under these kind of lower burning levels. It emits about a quarter a ton per day. of particulate matter is kind of our standard, and then it goes into those bigger burns. We also have, I think, what Billy might be referring to is on these ozone action days, we work at the beginning of the season to come up with something called ozone contingency plans. And that's where people, industry, the county, individuals can even sign up to do an ozone contingency plan. And these ozone contingency plans, when you sign up to do one, you get on this ozone action alert. And then when we call an action day, we do it the day before. You don't want to check out. That's one of the messages you'll get out from our, it's an email delivery system and a phone alert. Your phone will go off. So if they call one today about noontime, the message goes out and the phone will go off. And it says to folks, hey, we're calling an ozone action day for the next day. Look at the forecast. And when that happens, then people can take a look at, hey, what can we do that next day to prevent measures? And these are voluntary, they're not mandatory measures. But people, our experience has been people step up. The county will take a look and say, hey, do we have to, is there something we can defer? Companies will step up, hey, is there something we can defer? And this is one of the things that can be captured under in these ozone contingency plans is, you know, through the, you know, jurisdictional fire authority, being able to say, hey, you know, on those we can get some messaging out there when we get those folks calling to say, hey, I want to burn on something. Because we like, our rules require that you notify the jurisdictional fire authority. We're not a safety person entity at all. We're there just looking at the air pollution. And our role is to say, hey, is this really a day that we might see enough pollutants get in the air to cause health effects? And so we work together with those kind of agencies across the state. Jeff had good conversations with Shad. We really appreciate people kind of, because everybody's got a stake in the game.
Mr.
Chairman, some of this, I think, is just a review for some of us. But I remember when we first developed all these ozone contingency plans, and industry did it, the county did it. That's when Billy first got involved in it, is developing these plans of what are we going to not do when we have an ozone action day. So we have that in place, but I think in terms of the slash burning, it may be good to get a reminder out to the public, whether it's through Shad's office or through the county website or something, to just to remind people if you got a pile of junk you're thinking of burning, well, put it off and or don't do it during an ozone action day. I guess, which leads me to the question for Nancy, these last few action days we've had, I haven't been keeping up with the numbers. Have we actually been out of compliance with ozone, and how often?
Yeah, well, I've got those numbers for you. And I just would echo, we think a lot of this is communication. We need to, and we try to find ways in the air quality division to help improve communication. There have been a lot of ozone activity a number of years back. We went 5 years without having anything. And we had, last year was a good year. Year before was a high year. And so sometimes it's just taking, getting those wheels greased back up and getting that communication out there. And we appreciate, you know, working together, and we'll continue to do that to, because we think that's where a lot of the results can be. In terms of actual numbers, so our ozone season runs, and we call it ozone season because that's when we've seen the recorded high values, January 1st to March 31st. Typically in there, it's kind of middle of February to mid-March is kind of the highest level. It's a combination of the meteorology, so the sun angle, snow, you got plenty of it. In fact, driving over, it looks like it's got diamonds, so really reflective. And then there's usually an inversion of sorts that holds and traps kind of the pollutants in there, and then there's the pollutants, the nitrogen oxides and the volatile organic compounds. And and if I go on too long, just tell me, because I sometimes do that. I want to get to your question, though, but I want to make sure everybody has that kind of background understanding. the ozone, EPA sets ozone standards, and they set them based on a health level. And so in 2008, the health level was 75 parts per billion of ozone. And ozone's formed, it's a complex chemical reaction. Apparently there's 200 such chemical reactions that can occur to form ozone. But it takes energy source, so the sunlight, it takes nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds, and that sets off the reaction. And so the health-based standards is in 2008 was 75. And so that's what, when this area, the Upper Green River Basin, was declared non-attainment, it meant that we were above that health-based standard. Lots of measures came in place, the community, government, industry all came together, and by 2015 we were below that standard. So we were meeting and attaining the health-based standard that was set in 2008. We are still meeting and attaining that health-based standard set in 2008. But what EPA does over time is, as they look at the health-based studies, they lower take a look and see if they need to lower that standard. It got lowered in 2015 to a 70 parts per billion. So to your question, Mr. Bousman, that goes to what standard we've exceeded, is that 70 parts per billion. So EPA goes through a designation process at that 2015 standard, 70 parts per billion. Ozone is a standard that you look at 3 years worth of data, you look at an 8-hour range, and you take in a year, you look and see what's your fourth high for that year, and that goes into 1 year. You do that for the second year, you do that for the third year, you average it together, and if you come out 71, you're above the standard. 70 and below, you're okay. 71 and above, you're above that standard. We haven't had most places see ozone in the summertime, not here, it's the wintertime. And so, but we still have to look at a 12-month year. What we've got so far for this ozone season, we've got 5 monitors in the Upper Green River Basin. We're only having issues at one monitor, and that's the Boulder station. We have had a total of, we've had 6 elevated, so above the 71, at the Boulder station. The fourth high currently is at 73. The highest we've seen was 91, and that was on March 10th. It was a Sunday. And then the rest have ranged mostly in the, all the others have been in the 70s. So we've exceeded the standard for this year at that Boulder station. And assuming that 73 is the highest fourth, that'll go into that formula. So it's above 70. You got to look at, last year we were lower, I think in the 50s, and the year before I think we were at 72. So on a 3-year average basis, so assuming that number holds, we're still in attainment, but you get a year drop off and then you go forward the next year. So we always want to, our target is to be at 70 or below on an hourly basis. We have had on the hourly basis 51 1-hour values so far this ozone season that have been above that standard. So that's why it translated into these 6 exceedances at Boulder. We've had one, and that's the only place we've had the 8-hour exceedance. We've had 1-hour exceedances on 3 different days at Jewel Spring. At Daniel, yesterday we exceeded the 1-hour, that was the only day. And then in Pinedale, we've had 1 hour above a 71, and that was on March 6. So we've had 51 times with the 1 hour value over, but only the 6 days at the Boulder station. We're doing our best. We talked to, so when we had this really high value on March 10th after that, just to let you know the actions we've taken, we contacted the big operators. Again, Boulder Monitor, the others are throughout the basin. We're not seeing the basin-wide activity except, I think, on one day so far this year. We could say, hey, it looks like it's kind of basin-wide emissions. The other days have been focused all at the Boulder Monitor. monitored. We haven't seen those exceedances basin-wide. So we took a look at the operations just to the south, southwest of the Boulder Monitor, because that seems to be the wind direction, and to contacted those operators. So we contacted Ultra, PEP, Jonah, and Endeavor. We just contacted some of the larger ones to say, hey, this is pretty serious. They take it seriously. This has big economic consequences to each of those operators. We know it affects the health of the citizens of the Upper Green River Basin, and we take it seriously as well for both of those reasons. And we said, what can you do? Well, one of them is moving a drill rig out of the area. They're not going to drill there. They're seeing economic business consequences. They have limited, canceled, delayed contractor activities. They're not doing some of the liquids unloading that they do. No vehicle idling. They demobilized completions crews. Some have installed electric heat trace pump and turned off heaters during the day, so they have to prevent freeze up, but they're trying to limit the emissions from that. They've delayed well blowdown activities. They've shut down workover and swab rigs. They've shut down or deferred well pad construction, completions, recompletions, or workovers, and have shut in some wells. So they're taking it very, very seriously. They've also done some other things that I call, lighter telecommuting, teleworking to minimize specific vehicle emissions. But they're taking it seriously, doing what they can. That doesn't mean our work is over. We have a pre-winter ozone season open house before we start the season. And then we do one in the usually towards May, because we have to analyze all this information. The staff's real busy trying to figure all this stuff out. And we'll come back up to the Upper Green in May to give you some more detailed information. But that, to get to your question, yes, there have been exceedances. We're above the health-based standard on an annual basis, but not on the average as of today.
Thank you.
And Nancy, I think we're going to have to be moving forward, I guess, with our agenda. But one question, and I guess this is, it may not even be pertinent, but is there any consideration that maybe that monitor needs to be calibrated?
Yes, that's a good question. So it is calibrated. We have contractors that come out there and take a look at it. The data that I'm giving you today is what's called non-QA data, because there's certain how the monitors run and operate. They get a systems audit, and we look back at all that data. We can't do it right now when the season's in place, but we do take a look and make sure that it was all operating and functional. To our best of our knowledge, it is, but we'll take a look at it at the end of the season, and that's why you'll see all sorts of disclaimers from us, non-QA data, because it could change a little bit depending on that. We did have the Jewel Springs monitor go down, occasional monitors go down. I think today, and we do pull canisters to try and speciate these some of the volatiles that are coming off on an ozone action day. But yes, that's a good point.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask one question?
You just did.
It sounds like that everybody in the county, from the oil companies to Shad, and everybody is working very diligently. What about the people outside the county? When you talk about wind direction, are we getting stuff from Salt Lake City? Are we getting it from Sweetwater County that we can't control?
So to the best of the air quality division's knowledge right now, it does not appear that that's the case, that it's coming in from elsewhere. It appears that it's contained within the basin area. There's something called background ozone, which is kind of your starting point to see where you go. The thing is, when we found out about ozone, we don't know what the background levels were here to start with. So
okay.
What's in that background?
So there was no baseline to begin with.
Correct.
This all started with.
The baseline could be 50 parts.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
To Commissioner Bowsman's comment, Shad, I think communication is the key, and I think getting that information out on your website is the direction we want to take. Is the commission agreeable to having Shad and myself perhaps have a conversation with the sheriff regarding dispatch and trying to get them pointed in the direction that Shad needs to take with regards to people calling about birds.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sounds good.
So, Shad, I think Sheriff's out of town this week. If you could try to set that up, have a conversation, let me know. I'd be glad to come have that conversation with the both of you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
Happy to come back anytime you
have
questions.
Thanks for coming all the way from Cheyenne to talk to us.
We care, and we wanted to make sure to get this in front of you, and appreciated Shad reaching out to Jeff and talking to you about Vernon as well. So thank you.
Yes, we care, and we'll continue to work the best we can with the division.
Okay, thank you.
Shad, you might as well stay right up there.
Okay. Pretty good package. I guess to summarize, normally I give my Camp Fire Warning report. That's been emailed to anybody. I stand for any questions, but hearing none, I'm happy to move on without it. So, at your discretion, do you have any questions on the Fire Warning report or the monthly radio report?
I don't.
No, I'm good.
Thank you, good, Sam. Thank you.
Some of the action items I need to accomplish today was the Pierce proposal that we talked about 2 weeks ago. I've thoroughly reviewed the proposal that we've received. There's a checklist of 530 items of specific requirements on that engine. I went through that. There was a couple of minor discrepancies. I've communicated back and forth with Pierce. They've addressed all of my concerns. They provided all the documentation that I needed. I feel comfortable making a recommendation to the board that we award the contract to Pierce to move forward with building the fire apparatus as presented. So the next steps would be is if the board approves the proposal we received, we would then submit the paperwork to the state of Wyoming, to the state loan investment board, and for their mineral royalty grant, they'll review everything. Once they give me final written approval that the grant reimbursement will be provided, then we can move forward, sign the contract with Pierce, and actually get started building this truck.
So in our motion, Shad, to accept the contract, do we need to include the language that we discussed in terms of the prepayment?
Yes, sir. So the proposal that I'd asked for, I'd included some specific requirements from the manufacturers to provide incentives for prepayment and incentives. There was a 50%, a 75%, and a 100% prepayment. The other thing I included in the requirements for the bid was that anybody that was successful would have to provide proof of a performance bond. Pierce has provided that for us. And what a performance bond really does is it protects our investment if we do provide a prepayment, and it ensures that the contract will be explicitly complied with, and that anything that's in the contract documentation has to be met at the end when we take final acceptance of the truck. If there's any discrepancies at the end, then they'll actually pull the performance bond, and that has tremendous negative consequences for the manufacturing company if they have a performance bond pulled, because it affects their ability to do future business with other fire departments across the country. I did some research. I actually was glad to see Mark here today. I've contacted our insurance company, made sure I understood exactly what the performance bond does, and based on the conversations I had, I do feel comfortable making a recommendation to the board to do the 100% performance bond and take advantage of the prepayment incentives that Pierce is providing. I feel confident that the performance bond will protect our best interests and allow us to make the biggest bang for the buck for the proposals we've received.
So do you have a contract to present to us for approval today that's been reviewed by Matt?
I do not have a contract. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I've been working diligently with the manufacturer. Unfortunately, the attorney with Pierce has not come to a final agreement on the contract clauses, and I do not have that with me today. I think despite that, we can still move forward with the proposal, allow the attorneys to work out the differences in the clauses that we require. Specifically, what the county attorney's office has asked for is the governmental immunity clause needs to be in there, that we don't give up our governmental immunity, and that if there is any adjudication, it needs to occur in Wyoming. And those were the two clauses that needed to be included in the contract. That information has been provided to Pierce. They're currently reviewing the addition of the two clauses, and I'm waiting for them to get back with a final approval from their attorney's side. And then once our attorney gives us a final go-ahead, then I can present something to the board. But unfortunately, I don't have it today.
Do you need from us a motion to accept the bid? We talked about this last time. You were going to review it. You're now saying you're reviewing it. So you're ready for us to entertain a motion to accept a motion from Pierce on this fire apparatus. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, should I wait until we have the motion?
You have questions? Go ahead, Mr. Pickett.
Okay. So let me formulate this in my mind. I think the initial cost was $787,881. That was the number that I wrote down 6 weeks ago. So with the grant, and is the grant a guarantee? Because these are important numbers for me.
So I have the signed grant agreement with me today, and I'm happy to provide that. We've already had Commissioner Burnett sign the grant agreement, and the state has agreed to provide reimbursement for up to $360,000 for the cost of that truck. That is signed and ready. It's contingent on their final approval of the award of the bid, though. So once the commission has made that award, I send it to the state. They make final approval. They send it back to me, and everything's in place.
Okay. Excuse me. The grant is for what?
Do you mind if I show him? So I was prepared for this. I'd done a couple of lining up of numbers here. So I've got the cost of the original apparatus, the cost of the performance bond included in there, and then I've got some information about the reimbursement from the state loan investment board mineral royalties grant, and I've got information in there about the estimated value of engine 111 that we'll sell. I was misquoted in the newspaper. I've never said that we're going to get $100,000 for the truck. I said it wouldn't be more than $100,000. I went back and looked through my emails. I have an email from the Brenda Lee Mountain. It's an online auction company that we've worked with before and had good success. They've given me an estimate of between $70,000 and $90,000 is the value of engine 111. There's no guarantee we'll receive that, but that's what they've appraised the truck at, and they suggest that we list it online at that price.
And you're exactly right, because the representative from Pierce at the last meeting said he thought it might be more reasonable to expect that we'd get the $75,000 range.
The other thing I'll make note, since I never said that the truck would last 30 years either. The quote paper misquoted me on that. My expectation is that 20 years is a reasonable time frame. I've actually got documentation with me. The National Fire Protection Association provides recommendations and guidelines on how long to keep a primary truck in service to provide public protection. And what they essentially say, and I've actually got it with me if anybody wants to see it, but they suggest that after 15 years of online service, any fire truck should be removed from primary response to reserve response. And the truck that we're talking about is 20 years old. And then they suggest that at 20 years old, you need to critically review your apparatus, make sure that it's dependable. And then they recommend that anything older than 25 years of service should be removed from service. And so we're right in the middle of the nationally accepted best practices that are adopted by the National Fire Protection Association.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion that we move forward with the bid from Pierce and prepay 100% to obtain that.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Yes.
Before you move forward, I'm sure this has been contemplated, but bankruptcy is always an issue when you shovel a ton of money to somebody, and so I don't know if there's been research done on the history of this company and to make sure that that's not likely an issue, but the bond issue, I assume, would not address that. Obviously it could, because you can't contract out of a bankruptcy. So I just want to point that out, that if you're going to throw all this money out there, it's probably not a risk, but it's something that needs to be considered.
Thank you.
Chad, you want to when Chad called me about the bond, when he was talking about the performance bond, and the question he asked is, what does that mean for us? One thing that happens with a bond is that the primary factor behind bond is financial responsibility. Bond is unlike an insurance contract. The losses aren't factored in. So when an insurance company or a bond company is going to issue a special performance bond, they do extensive background on financials, because what happens is if the company, in this case, is
doesn't deliver, the bond company has to pay it. But on the surety bond, the bond company now goes back and collects against the principal. So they want to make sure that principal has money and can support that bond before they'll ever issue a bond. Bonds are all about financial responsibility. So if they've granted a performance bond, the bond company is very secure with the fact that if these guys do default, they can get their money back from them. So that might answer your question.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark, for that. I think we were in the middle of a motion by Commissioner Noble.
I'll second, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Good enough.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second to accept the bid proposal from Pierce Manufacturing for this fire apparatus with the inclusion of taking advantage of the 100% prepayment option. Now, discussion from Mr. Pippen.
Yes, sir. Since I have been on this board, it has been told to me that Sublette County is not a bank. Would appear to me we're operating here as a bank. We are loaning the full amount to buy a unit a year out. And I can't support that. Sorry.
Well, Commissioner Vickery, I disagree with you in terms of we're loaning the amount. We have agreed to make this purchase in which two things in my mind come into consideration. Number one is that $800,000 that we've allocated in the budget previously to cover this will be paid out in this budget year and not have to be carried over to the next budget year. In addition, much to Shad's hard work and to our advantage, we also are now getting basically a $360,000 reprieve from having to pay the entire amount. And the last thing is, rather than loan money and gather interest, we're paying for this apparatus and saving the county $20,000 in the process. But I appreciate your opinion.
Well, I still, Mr. Chairman, I'm still not gonna, I just can't support it when I have been told Sublette County cannot be the bank, and in this instance, we are the bank. We are loaning Pierce, whatever the number ends up being, $787,000 to build a vehicle that we won't see for a year, perhaps. That, in my mind, is a loan. Now that's enough said for me.
Any other comments? If not, I'll call the question. We've got a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed?
Aye.
Okay. We have 4-1. Commissioner Vickery's opposed. Motion carries. Thank you.
All right. Things here.
A lot of my agenda today.
All right, so the next thing, a somewhat related topic. If you remember, we had a wildland fire truck that was out for bid. I made the recommendation to reject the bid that we'd received on that. I went back to the drawing board. I've produced a very generic template of a wildland fire truck that I think defines our intent, but leaves a lot of open-ended questions to the discretion of the manufacturer. I've worked with Matt Gaffney from the county attorney's office, reviewed the proposal as I've put it together. My thought would be that if with the board's approval, I'd like to send out the second attempt to solicit proposals this time rather than quotes. And the difference in my mind is that if I ask for a proposal, I'm asking for the manufacturer to show us what they build. If I ask for a quote, I'm telling them this is exactly what I want. Tell me how much it would cost. So this time I'm asking to solicit proposals from the various manufacturers. Tell them, you know, show me what your cookie cutter template is on a wildland fire truck meeting these specific parameters, and I've defined the parameters in my specification here, and then wait and see what we get back. But the conversation I had with Matt Gaffney was, as long as we make it very clear that analysis is going to be, we're going to choose the fire truck that best meets our needs, he felt it was appropriate to move forward with the release of that. So today what I'd like to do is just receive approval from the board to release a second issuance of a request for proposals this time rather than quotations and see what we receive back from the manufacturers.
Any problems or concerns with Chad's request?
Makes sense.
I agree. Do you want a motion?
I think we just need direction.
Just direction.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you very much for that. The next thing I have is, I remember I came in a couple months ago, I had a textbook, it's the preeminent textbook in the country that trains firefighters. I've been asked again by the organization, the International Fire Service Training Association that produces that textbook, they've asked me to participate on the 8th edition of that textbook. So I've got the application in hand, but reason why I'm asking for permission from the board is that it takes about 3 years to produce that textbook. The agreement we've had in the past is that the county will pay for me to. There's two meetings I need to attend per year, face-to-face meetings that I need to attend. They both occur in Oklahoma. In the past, what we've done is the county has paid for me to fly to the January meeting, and then IFSTA pays for me to fly to the July meeting. So it's a kind of a cost share where they pay half of it and we pay half of it. What I'd be asking for from the board today is approval to move forward with that same arrangement and allow me to participate on the validation committee that produces the textbook that trains firefighters and provide input from a rural firefighters' perspective and trying to make sure that the content that's included in that textbook meets the needs of volunteer firefighters.
Is there any concerns or questions?
I'd say absolutely. Kudos to Sullivan County Unified Fire.
Have that direction? Carrie, let the minutes reflect that, please.
Okay. Thank you very much for supporting that. I appreciate it.
Sir, just one quick question, and I know this is going backwards. I didn't quite see it in the report. Maybe I didn't read it as I should. Where do we stand with the Enterprise Tower and that analysis being done?
Absolutely. So the five tower design, four of the five towers have been completed. If you remember, the Marbleton Tower came back originally and was suggested that it would fail. They've come back, looked closer at what was going on in the Marbleton Tower. They've fixed that. It's come back as being able to pass the structural engineering requirements that were necessary for that tower. So four of the five towers, everything's in place. We're ready to move forward. The fifth tower that you had asked a question about, the Enterprise Tower, they have completed the field survey. They've done the soil sample. They've looked at the concrete footings and foundations, and we're currently awaiting the final report. I have not received that report. I expect it any day, though, and based on that report, then we'll have some direction on what's necessary to bring that tower up to compliance to be able to mount equipment on it and not cause it to structurally fail.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
When I looked at that, I thought I saw something said, Big Sandy Tower. Is that the Enterprise Tower? Which one is that? You might see one in here somewhere that said.
We haven't referred, we either refer to it as, its technical location is called the Jonah Tower, but Enterprise owns the lease from BLM on that. So in general nomenclature, we've referred to it as the Enterprise Tower, but on paper, the application agreement refers to it as a Jonah Tower. I don't believe I've ever referred to it as the Big Sandy Tower, though.
I'm sorry, I didn't misread this
thing. Yeah, I think so. I didn't. Okay. Any other questions for Chad? Okay, Chad, thank you.
Thanks, Chad.
One thing I wanted to address, Commissioner Vickery had some questions about our long-range planning. I wanted to bring to the Commission's attention, we do have a 10-year capital improvement plan. We've updated that on a regular basis, and last night during our command staff meeting, we updated it again. I wanted to provide a copy for the board to review, just to see the updates that we've included and be aware that that's a big part of my job is trying to plan for those large capital improvement projects and budget accordingly. So I wanted to provide a copy of that to the board for your reading pleasure. I don't expect to review it at this moment. I just wanted to give it to you and maybe stand for questions maybe next month or whatever's convenient for you if there's any questions about it. But just based on Commissioner Vickery's questions last month, I did want to make sure that everybody understood that a big part of my job is planning for the purchase of those large fire apparatus and fire stations and et cetera. And we've clearly identified the matrix that we use to prioritize which trucks need to be replaced at what time frame and what criteria we've included to make that decision-making process, and that's all included in the capital improvement plan that I provided for you.
Very good. Thank you, Shane.
Okay. Check my notes here, make sure I'm caught up. All right. The last thing I have is I'd like to bring Todd up here and have a conversation about the progress on the station in Daniel, the fire station in Daniel. Todd's got a lot of progress that's been made here in the last couple of weeks.
Just a minute, Chad, is that what we were going to have on at 10:30?
I believe so, yes, sir.
Yeah, the only reason I say that, I think we probably need to go with Billy because we advertised that we were going to be opening those bids at 10:15.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you can wait 15 minutes, we'll have Billy come up now.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
All right, we've got some bids and the leftover stuff. I just typed it up and I highlighted the highest bid. I'm happy with all of them. On the road and bridge stuff, the trailers, when I had them appraised, which was almost a year ago, for road and bridge, they were past the DOT inspection. They couldn't pass no more without a lot of work. And the one bid I got that have the one to have the belly dumps brought back up to DOT, it was they wouldn't give me an exact quote, but it was anywhere from 20 to 30,000. That's why we decided to get rid of them and upgrade. But having them appraised, they appraised for me $8,000 to $16,000. It just depended on the auction, how they were going and stuff. So on the belly dumps, on the bid number 203, which is a 2003 belly dump, Brad White offered $8,500. On the second belly dump, which is a 2004, Rocky Kiernick offered $10,000. On the van trailer, which it was, the appraised value on that was, he said anywhere from $3,000 to $4,000 on that trailer. Gary Iden offered $3,500. Then we had some pickups. They were basically old fairground pickups, the pickups that didn't sell. We had a 98 bid number 141. It's just an F-150. There was only one bid on that, and that was Buck Ganscombe. And he bid $557. Bid number 173 was a 2000 Ford F-150, and Buck Ansball was the highest bid on that for $1,057. The last truck was a bid number 171, was a 91 Ford F-250. The highest bid on that was Casey Calhoun at $400. and we had a little boat trailer. I really don't know where that came from, but the highest bid on that was Dan Barron at $50. And then we had an old Hinkey V plow. And Larry Dennison was the highest bid on that for $300.
Motion's been made to accept high bids on all of these items. Do we have a second?
Second.
Been seconded by Commissioner Bowsman. Any discussion?
I guess my one question, Mr. Chairman, are we done, Billy?
We're done.
Okay.
Well, I'd just like to make the comment that these are items that weren't bid or didn't meet minimum bid the first time around, and these bids add up to a total of $24,364, yeah. So that's quite a good deal.
Yeah, I was
good
I
job.
Thought it was great.
Any other comments? If not, I'll call for a vote. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Motion carries.
That's really all I have.
Okay.
Thanks, Billy.
Thanks.
We'll do a short break. Yeah. We'll take a short 5 minute recess and then we'll come back to you, Chef.
Seems cold in here, isn't it?
I feel okay.
It's a little chilly.
You got a